and the recording started.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Member Conduct Committee. Please also note that under the Openness of Local Government Bodies Regulation 2014, that other people may film, record, tweet or blog from this meeting. The use of any images or sound recordings is not under the Council's control. Item number one. Apologies. Have we any apologies? Karen Winston?
I need to sit down.
Yes, we've received apologies from Councillor Ranson. However, we have got Councillor Andy Paling subbing tonight, and also from Vicky Ball. I believe that Councillor Ward is coming, but she will be here shortly, hopefully.
Thank you. Item number two, minutes of the previous meeting. To confirm as correct, record the minutes of the meeting held on the 20th of September 2021. Any comments on the minutes of the previous meeting? Can we approve them? Minutes, yes?
Yes.
Everybody approve them? Thank you very much. Item number three, disclosures of pecuniary and personal interest. Are there any disclosures of pecuniary and personal interest?
No.
None? Thank you very much. After the next item, I hope to move item number eight up. Is everyone okay with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Four, questions under committee procedure. There are no questions were received. We'll now go to item number eight, Members' Code of Conduct and Planning Code of Good Practice. Is Richard going to speak on it?
I'll open it up.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. So, as part of the annual review of the Constitution, we undertake a review of the Planning Code of Good Practice and the Members' Code of Conduct, which is on the agenda as another agenda item. In terms of the Planning Code of Good Practice, members of this committee, the Member Conduct Committee, and the members of the Plans Committee were asked for comments. We did receive one comment back. And the one comment was from Councillor Forrest about attendance at Plans Committee from speakers. I then subsequently asked Richard Bennett for his response to that query that came through from Councillor Forrest. And at this point, Richard may wish to say something. Thank you.
Richard Bennett, would you like to speak, please?
Yes, good evening, members. Through you, Chair, if I may just comment. In the report, it says that this issue has been a matter of some frustration to members of the committee over the last couple of years, where some ward councillors have called items in but then have not been available to explain the planning reasons for why they called it in at the committee. On the night, and you know, as I say in the report, there some items are you know, really not very controversial at all, and it's difficult for a committee to understand what the key points that the Royal Council was concerned about if they're absent or if they've not had a stand-in for them to explain the reasons why they've called it in. You know, in case that they may have missed a nuance that needs to be brought to the attention of the members in the debate. So it is a matter of some frustration. I have to say that in responding to committee services through this consultation, I did say that you know, the points that Councillor Forrest had raised were well made. I hadn't quite realised that the suggestion was that meant it was a proposal to amend paragraph 7.2 of the Constitution. As you can see further down in the report, in section 4, it's got the role of ward members and an extract from paragraph 7.2 of the it's actually the Members' Planning Code of Good Practice, the section of the Constitution that's highlighted there, section 7.2. The Members' Planning Code of Good Practice is about ensuring that planning decisions are made openly, impartially and with sound judgment and for justifiable reasons. So the paragraph you've got there is about councillors' speaking rights. So perhaps that isn't quite the right place where we members might want to be thinking about making any changes in respect to this issue that Councillor Forrest has raised. If I take you further down the item to the Plans Committee meeting procedures, which is extract 12.12 in the report which follows 7.2, if you follow through the text, there is an area highlighted in bold text, which I just read from, Chair. It says, ward councillors who call in a planning application are expected to attend the Plans Committee meeting at which it is considered. If a ward councillor who has called in a planning application is unable to attend the meeting, he or she is able to and should identify another councillor to speak on his or her behalf. I think the point that Councillor Forrest is making is actually addressed in that element of the meeting procedures. In my response to Councillor Forrest, which I forwarded to the Democratic Services, I suggested that members tonight might want to consider whether that statement needed to be more direct. Instead of expected to attend, the wording should be must attend. And that's about as much as I could offer to the committee to try and exercise those members that call in applications to attend. So at that point, Chair, if I leave it for members to consider that point.
Thank you, Richard. Any comments, Councillor Rowley?
Thank you. I think we should change it to must. I think it's quite a decision for an application to be called in, and I don't think that should be taken lightly. So if a councillor is going to go as far as calling in an application, I think they should attend the committee and explain why, because I'm conscious that some councillors will call in with very little comments, and I think that's happened to planning officers before, where they'll get very little reasoning as to why they're asking for that application to be called in. So I think must should be changed. The only other addition that occurred to me when I was reading these papers earlier was that for those of us that don't have the benefit of a political party to nominate someone else to attend on their behalf, maybe we should allow a written submission to be put in on behalf of the councillor, and I welcome Richard Bennett's comments on that.
Is that a proposal?
Yes.
Councillor.
Yes, it is, but we'll hear Richard
first. Oh, let's hear Richard. Would you like to respond to that, please?
Thank you, Chair. Through you, if I may. So it is the case that some councillors have provided written submissions to the Chair, and the Chair has read them out at the meeting. I haven't canvassed the view of the Chair of Plans Committee to see if she would be content with that, that proposal. I do see that we have the Vice-Chair of Plans Committee in the room this evening. I can't speak for the Chair on that matter, but I do know that it has happened before in the past.
Thank you, Richard. Councillor Paley.
Thank you, Chair. And again, just to reiterate what Richard actually said, at the last plans meeting, Councillor Bentley was actually the chair of the meeting, and one of the ward members had called an application in, and he did read the statement out to the rest of the planning. So as far as I'm concerned, that procedure is a robust one, whereas if the chair or the vice chair is asked to read the statement out, I think that should be approved.
Councillor Bentley.
Did Councillor Rollins want to come back first on that?
Yes, that's okay, Chair. So briefly, I think it's important just for those, we have got a couple of members that aren't either in a political party or they're a single member of a political party that may find it more challenging to nominate someone to attend on their behalf. So I think, like I say, my proposal would be that we change it to must, but in order to be fair, we then add a line to say that a written submission will be accepted by Plans Committee and read out on behalf of that councillor in the event they're not able to attend and not able to provide a substitute. The only other thing that I would add is perhaps when planning officers are receiving calling applications, they ought to remind councillors of this particular part of our constitution so they're aware of what their obligations are on calling in an application. But I'd make the proposal that we change it to must and allow provision for written submission to be made in the absence of a substitute.
I'll second that recommendation.
Chair.
Yes, ma'am. Councillor Draycott.
Thank you. Can I just ask how often this happens, and is it a regular, the same councillors, or is it a cross-section of councillors? If I could just have those answers first, I think that would help me with anything further I need to say. Thank you.
Have we got that information?
It's not always councillor Ian, but it's not always the same councillor, but it is fairly regular, and it's annoying because the officers have put quite a lot of time and trouble to present these cases before the Plans Committee, and the councillor who called it in really should make the effort to actually be there. And about one in three, possibly one in four, maybe don't attend themselves, which I don't think is on. So Councillor Paling stole my thunder. I was going to second Councillor Rowling's proposal.
Any other comments, Councillor Draycott?
Sorry, Chair. So another question. So if the report is on the agenda, does it have to be taken, or is it there solely because a certain member has requested it? Can it not be taken? I'm asking whether there's a legal requirement that it has to be considered and decided upon.
Adrian, would you like to?
Councillor, so Richard Bennett would be the best one to answer that.
Richard Bennett?
Through you, Chair, I'm not a lawyer, but what it says, the Constitution sets out the route for decision making, and it sets out a call-in procedure, and if a member has called in an application to the Plans Committee, it must be considered by the Plans Committee unless the committee decides to delegate it back down to the head of planning, if you like. So there'd still need to be a decision from the Plans Committee. I think that's right. I'm looking towards my colleagues in Adrian Ward or Karen Whittison just to confirm that point.
Perhaps, Chair, I think once an item is on the agenda of Plans Committee, that's then a public sort of summons to the meeting, and you may potentially then have applicants and objectors and other people who've given up time to attend the meeting. So I think seeking not to make a decision on the basis that a ward councillor who called it in wasn't able to attend, and sometimes the non-attendance is for a legitimate reason, like a sudden bereavement in the family.
Yes.
I think my strong advice would be that the committee should make a decision and carry on and consider the item once it's on the public agenda.
Okay, thank you.
Any more comments?
No, thank you, Chair.
Well, we have a proposal and a seconder. So we need to...
So I suggest, Chair, if you ask people, the councillors present in the room, to vote, and then ask the councillors present virtually how they would have voted if they'd been here.
Okay, so we have a proposal and a seconder to change it to must. All those in favour?
And also about the ability to submit in writing if they can't attend.
Just a point of clarification, if I may. What we're talking about here, I believe, is an amendment to section 12.12 of the meeting procedures, rather than the member code of conduct. Just a point of clarification.
Councillor Rollins.
Yeah, 12.12c, that's where the amendment will be in the paragraph.
Is it changing the word from expected to must?
Yeah, and then a sentence at the bottom just to make it clear that they can submit in writing if they're not able to find a substitute or attend on their behalf.
Sorry, Chair, can I also clarify that this would be in the form of a recommendation to full council to amend the constitution?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's going to be a recommendation to full council to amend the constitution. Going to change the word expected to must, and the ability to send a statement in if for some unexpected reason they can't attend.
Yeah.
That clear now? So all the councillors in the room, please, those four.
If you make that clear to
the recording. That's unanimous. four. And those on the screen, could you tell me which way you would have voted? Four. Two. Thank you very much indeed. That's two for the screen. 3-4 on the screen.
The
parish council
can't
vote. Parish
reps that can't vote, yeah. I'm afraid.
So there's Councillor Draycott and Councillor.
Yes, I noticed, Chair, that Leon's down as a guest, but I thought he was a permanent member of this.
It's because he's come on his private email. He's a
Okay. Thank you. Just clarify.
His hand up.
Who's got his hand up?
Leon.
Yes, he has.
Actually. Leon, you want to speak?
I just want to ask a question here.
Yes.
Are you saying I do not disagree to change actually the phraseology from expected to must, but if we put must, we made actually mandatory. Now, if somebody actually breaks the rule, what's the penalty?
Well, we've just voted, haven't we?
Yeah.
No, I'm just asking the question. Yeah. So, if actually we go with the must, it's fine. I understand this has already passed. All right, now then we need to look in the Constitution about the penalty of somebody who breaks the rule.
This will have to go to full council, though, won't it? Councillor Rollins, sorry.
No, I was probably here from Adrian, I guess, first.
Well, do you want to go first?
You go first.
I don't have the code of conduct in front of me, Chair, but my recollection is, and Karen may correct me if I'm wrong, that there is a section within the code of conduct that says that councillors are expected to comply with the council's policies and procedures, including the constitution. So potentially not coming and not submitting a written statement and not arranging for another councillor to come and speak on your behalf could potentially lead to a code of conduct complaint.
Is that okay, councillor?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. That's that item. Yeah. Thank you very much. Then we'll move on now to.
Are you happy for Richard Bennett to go?
Richard Bennett, you can leave the meeting now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night. Item number 5, update on complaints received.
Do you want me to introduce this, Chair?
Yes, please.
So this is the regular update report, keeping the council, the committee informed. Complaints that have come in since the last meeting in September. We've had 3 complaints that are summarised in Appendix A on page 10. 2 of the complaints were about borough councillors, and they were both in relation to, funnily enough, calling in planning applications. They, at the fact-finding stage, I consider that there was no evidence that the councillor had acted inappropriately. The independent person agreed with me, and so those 2 complaints did not progress any further. The most recent complaint was about a parish stroke town councillor from a member of the public alleging aggressive, threatening and bullying behaviour. Having considered the complaint, I felt that needed to be independently investigated, and again the independent person agreed with me. An update: since the report was written, that investigation is now concluded. And the investigator found that there had been no breach of the code of conduct, and having considered the investigator's report with the independent person, we both agreed with that. So again, that complaint will not progress any further. Happy to take any questions, Chair.
Any comments? Councillor Butler.
Well, it's just nice to see, Ben. I mean, this is the lowest tally we've ever had, I think, isn't it? It is. Since 2012, this is by far away the lowest. That's quite refreshing.
I think that's right, Chair, and whether the pandemic has had any impact on that, I don't know. Obviously, council meetings are still going ahead. For a while they were virtual, but now they've gone back to in person. So I agree with Councillor Bentley. From my point of view, it's very pleasing that the numbers of complaints are so low.
Any other comments, councillors?
No, not for me.
So we've just noted that. Okay then, can I move on to item number 6, Member Code of Conduct Update. To consider a report of the Monitoring Officer setting out potential options in respect of the Member Code of Conduct. Monitor Officer, please.
Thank you, Chair. So, members of the committee may remember at the September meeting, I brought 3 options to you at that stage. One was the unamended LGA National Code of Conduct. The other option was a version of the LGA code that had been amended locally by a group of monitoring officers in Leicestershire, and the third option was to maintain our current code of conduct. And in, at the September meeting, the committee decided to wait and see what the County Council decided to do in relation to which code of conduct they were going to adopt. The County Council have now adopted the amended, the locally amended LGA code. So what I've done is I've brought back a report to you to confirm that that's what they've done, and whittled it down really to two options to recommend to you. Either we keep the code of conduct we currently have, or we adopt the locally amended LGA code of conduct, which obviously we need to adapt the county version locally for Charnwood, which I've done in the appendix, should you be minded to adopt that code. I think there are benefits for dual-hatted members who are borough councillors and county councillors to have a common shared code of conduct. So I think there are benefits in adopting the same code that the county have adopted. Although I think my advice to you remains as it was in September, that particularly the interests requirements under the LGA code are more complex than our current requirements. And I think I've added in section 9 on page 15 a very useful summary that the monitoring officer at the county, I can't claim ownership of this, I adapted it from the monitoring officer's version at the county council, that tries to set out the various categories and subcategories of interests under the new code. So disclosable pecuniary interests remain as they are under the Localism Act 2011. There are then, and there's then a new category of other registrable interests with subcategories, and there is another new category of non-registrable interests, again with subcategories, and councillors will have to go through a thought process in relation to other registrable interests and non-registrable interests as to how they would have to declare and act on interests in any particular situation. So I think that's something to be aware of, that the interest section of the new code of conduct is more complex than our current version. And I've also tried to set out within the report the other main differences, perhaps the other notable one being dispensations. So our constitution at the moment says that dispensations are granted by this committee. So dispensations basically allow a council who has an interest that would normally mean they wouldn't be able to remain in the meeting and participate, debate and vote. They can in certain circumstances be granted a dispensation. The current requirement for this committee to grant a dispensation in the real world probably wouldn't work, because it has to be done between the period between an agenda being issued and the meeting. So the LGA code of conduct suggests that the monitoring officer should be responsible for granting dispensations in the first instance. So again, if we were to adopt the LGA code, I've included a recommendation that would give me delegated authority to grant dispensations. Although it's worth noting, in the 10 years since the Localism Act came into force, we've never had a councillor who's requested a dispensation, Chair. So happy to answer any questions.
Councillors, any questions? Councillor Rawlings.
Do we know if any other districts or boroughs have adopted the amended code yet?
Chair, through you, they all seem to be pushing ahead with adopting the LGA locally amended code.
Okay.
I'm not aware of any of them that aren't.
Councillor Bellaway.
I think it may be prudent, Chair, to mirror the County Council's amended version. So we're running in sync with the County Council. I think it'd be prudent to do that, unless anybody's got...
Councillor Draycott.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Can I ask a couple of questions? First, where it refers to non-registrable interests, is no kind of examples given? So if we're talking about a non-registrable interest, which doesn't have to be declared unless the situation arises, what examples would those be? And the words well-being is used a lot in the document, and what exactly would that mean? I could see that being used in different ways, so that would need to be pinned down as to what actually well-being means. Just those two things. And just while I'm speaking, Chair, on the declaration of interest forms, is there any way that we could tighten up the fact that not all members complete forms and send them in? Because I actually think that's very important, and I know this committee over the years has tried to persuade councillors of the importance of them and for them to be returned, but that still doesn't happen. So is there some way in this document that we could actually strengthen the fact that all councillors need to complete these forms, not only that, but update them during the year? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
So through you, Chair, non-registrable interests are basically any interest that is not registered on your register of interests. So,
well done.
So, thinking of examples, for example, if you are a member of the Plans Committee and your brother submits a planning application for his house, you obviously won't have declared on your register of interest that your brother owns a house in the borough. But you obviously, as a member of the Plans Committee, you, either your brother will tell you, oh, I've submitted a planning application, or you will see it appearing on the agenda and you'll recognise the applicant's name and the address. So your brother submitting a planning application, if you sat on the Plans Committee, that would be a non-registrable interest. So it's something that isn't on your own register of interest, but it's something that's cropped up during business of the committee that you are a member of, that you need to disclose an interest in. Does that make sense, Councillor Draycott?
Would it be helpful to have an example included in the document? Because I think all members need to be aware and have a bit more information on that matter.
I don't think we can include examples within the Code of Conduct itself, Chair, but if we do adopt the LGA Code, we would have to provide training to all members, so we could certainly go through and make some examples in the training, Councillor Draycott.
Yes, that would be fine, thank you.
Okay, Councillor Butler.
Yeah, I think if you're starting to list examples, then that list is not going to be an exhaustive list, but it would need to be, because you'd have to refer to every possible scenario, because otherwise something could be left out that should have been included. So therefore, I don't think you can. I think a separate advisory to councillors giving that example, but the example you've just given, clearly, if one of my relations making a planning application and I'm serving on a plans committee, then clearly you can't take part or shouldn't take part, because it could lead to bias.
It's also worth noting, Chair, that there are some very extensive guidance notes that the LGA have provided that are available online that go through all of their code of conduct in great detail and give, I don't know, from memory, I can't remember if they give examples, but they certainly explain the requirements in quite a lot of depth and detail, Chair.
Okay, would this be covered in training then, wouldn't it? Would be to councillors during training.
Yeah.
Councillor Rollins?
I think the registering of interest point that Councillor Draycott makes is obviously covered by statute anyway, so it's an offence not to return it. So I don't see that being an issue. I think what Councillor Draycott's referring to is people updating them, because previously we would check, or Democratic Services would chase quite rightly for people to update, but actually there's no obligation on them or us as a committee to do that. That was just almost best practice, but the law is really clear on the fact that we are all obliged, and it's an offence not to return that form. So I'm sure that, I'll be correct if I'm wrong, but I can almost guarantee there won't be any councillors that haven't got a completed form on the website at the moment. In terms of the code, the adapted code, it's not perfect. I'm not massively keen on the style that it's written, as we spoke about in September. However, I do think it makes sense to have a uniformed approach. I expect that most of the districts and boroughs will probably agree and adopt what the council adopted. I'd imagine many of us held back pending the county council's decision. So my view is, whilst it's not perfect, this isn't fixed forever. We can tweak it just like we've tweaked our own over the years. And my view is we should adopt the amended code that's put before us tonight.
Sorry, Chair, I did ask another question that's not yet been answered.
I was just coming to that, Councillor Draycott. So well-being, and again, I can only do this really by thinking of an example. So if you sit on the licensing committee and the licensing committee is considering removing the license of the pub that you regularly drink at, you could argue that that decision would affect your well-being, i.e. your socialising, your meeting with your friends, to a greater extent than it would affect somebody who lives 10 miles away in another part of the borough but never visits that pub. So another example that I've seen given is, probably doesn't apply to us, it's more a county council function, but I think it's a useful example. If the county council were considering a footpath closure order, and it was a footpath that you regularly use to exercise, jog or walk your dog, that may affect your well-being more than it would affect other people who didn't use that footpath regularly. So those are the sort of examples I would give on well-being, Chair. The register of interests question, exactly as Councillor Rollings said, there is a legal requirement for all councillors to complete and declare their register of interest forms within 28 days of first being elected, and they are supposed to notify me of significant changes if and when they occur. We locally at Charnwood have chosen to go beyond the legal requirements, and we do have a, is it 6 monthly, Karen?
Yeah.
We have a 6 monthly reminder process where we send out people's register of interest to all councillors and ask them to confirm whether any updates are required or not. That is a nice to have. The response rate, and I think something we'll come back onto later on in the agenda, at the moment is very low, but there is no legal requirement for councillors to do that, particularly if there have been no changes. It's just something we have chosen to do locally, Chair, as really as an aide memoir every 6 months, so councillors get a chance to read through and check that there have been no changes.
Thank you. So is that a fact then, that all members have submitted a declaration of interest form?
Chair, is that relevant? Do you have to answer that here and now? Is that part of
all of our councillors have submitted a register of interest form following
Karen Widdowson.
And Karen speaking, so, and I can confirm my team processes those forms, and after the elections all councillors completed those forms within the 28 days of being elected, and then we do get regular updates. We don't just have them coming through at the 6 month points, at that when we do those reminders, we get them on a fairly regular basis of any changes such as somebody moving address or being now on a new outside body, etc.
Thank you.
Any other councillors want to comment?
No.
So do we have a proposal? So, Councillor Angela Nicolai.
Hi. I have a problem. I have a problem with the conflict of interest and the way it is perceived. You see, it is very simple actually to define conflict of interest where you are involved in decision which may lead to financial gain for yourself or the immediate members of your family. That's easy. Now, when we go to the footpath and we go to all the other bits and pieces, where you go to the pub and, you know, I go to the pub and they close the pub, I cannot go to the pub. Now, this actually, I think, personally, I think takes the mickey, because think about actually elected members of the public, all right? We have been elected in wards. So when actually somebody comes to you and says to you, oh, I have a problem, councillor, and can you help me with this one? You have a conflict of interest because you expect the vote of this person. So it is a conflict of interest. You're a member of a political party. It is a conflict of interest that you're a borough councillor. Because you see, if you want to be re-elected and you have allowances, all of us have some allowances, so there is financial interest. So, truth be actually, if we expand the concept of the conflict of interest, we all have conflict of interest. And now, I give you actually a very striking example. We had a new development in Rothley, and a member of the plans committee was Mark Charles. And Mark lives in Thurcaston, but he's a borough councillor for Rothley and Thurcaston. Now, this development was in Rothley, and he was asked actually to abstain from the vote in the plans committee because of conflict of interest. What was his conflict of interest? that he was representing roughly in Thurcaston, and he was in the plans committee, but he could not vote because he had a conflict of interest, because if he voted in a way that would satisfy actually the voters, the conflict of interest was actually that he was going for the votes. Now the entire thing now actually becomes a very, very bizarre thing. It comes 180 degrees towards us. If we're members of the party, if we're elected members in a ward, automatically we have conflict of interest in whatever we say. Can somebody answer this to me?
Councillor Rollins.
I think my interpretation from reading the amended code that's put forward tonight isn't that it expands what is or isn't a conflict or what is or isn't disclosable. It just presents it in a slightly different way. And I think every single conflict of interest is different, and you know, the talk of well-being and things like that, every single situation is so unique. I don't think there is an answer that we could put in policy that would fit every situation, and that's why we've got a monitoring officer, and that's why we've got guidance to support what we're looking at today. But you know, the examples you give, there will be cases and there will be times where there could be a perceived conflict where there is actually no bias that would take place there, and you may be allowed to vote on something. So I think that to keep it onto what we're looking at tonight, what we're voting on, I don't think that we are widening the scope of conflict of interest. I don't think, if you look at our current code of conduct versus this, I don't think that we are widening the definition or making more cases where a conflict might arise, in my view.
Does it make sense, though? I'm sorry, actually, I insist on this one. Does it make sense that the point of gravity in conflict of interest is actually financial gain for yourself or the immediate members of your family? Because if we go actually into the very wider definition of conflict of interest, I'm sorry, everybody who is taking part in this meeting has conflict of interest one way or another.
Councillor Rollins.
I don't, it's not just financial though, so I disagree. I haven't got any conflict of interest on the agenda tonight. There's no benefit for voting one way or the other. I think the point you're making is you might represent the ward and it might be favourable to your ward to vote one way, but I still think it's individual situations, and I still don't think that what we're being asked to vote on tonight is any different in terms of what is or isn't a conflict. It's just a different code of conduct that happens to be the new, you know, recommendation to us, but I still don't think we're widening the scope of that definition. So I don't think it's an issue in that sense. I don't think we're conflicted. You know, I don't think we've all got a conflict of interest sitting here tonight. And I still think it needs to be individual councillors making decisions on what is or isn't a conflict, as and when potential issues may or may not arise.
Well, thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, Chair. I think it'd be helpful to look at the middle of page 15 where it talks about the test. So the test basically is, and this is, the, as Councillor Rollins has said, this is the same as our current code of conduct. The test is what the view of an informed member of the public would be, knowing the facts. So would an informed member of the public, going back to some of the examples we've used earlier, if you were on the plans committee and you were considering your brother's planning application, would an informed member of the public think that you had an open mind in relation to that planning application?
No.
Correct. And I think I would agree, that's a very obvious one. And going back to Councillor Hadji Nicolaou's example of voting on a planning application in your ward, the planning code of good practice is very clear that when you sit on the plans committee, you are there to represent the interests of the borough as a whole, not your own ward. And planning committee is also non-political. Mm-hmm. So Conservative, Labour, Green, none of those political factors should come in at all in a plans committee decision. It should be what are the relevant planning considerations and what is the best decision for the borough as a whole, if that makes sense, Chair. Mm-hmm.
Councillor Bedler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think all members, when they agree to serve on the plans committee,
need to go and be prepared to listen to the evidence that's being put forward by the officers, the speakers representing either for or against, or in some cases could be fairly neutral about the application. But if they can't enter into that arena with an open mind to be persuaded one way or another with the arguments given, they shouldn't be there. So if you go in there with a closed mind, you just shouldn't be in that meeting at all.
Right.
You sometimes see cases, and I can think of one in particular, where a member who never attends planning attended for one item and didn't stay for the rest of the anything else, just came in for one item, had an agenda, voted the way he wanted to vote, and then left. And I'm not going to say who that was.
No.
Absolutely I won't. But that's completely wrong. And anybody looking at that from outside could say, well, yeah, surely he
that's
was predetermined, and that is wrong.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Any other comments, councillors?
I still have the difficulty. I understand, obviously, all the elements which were explained in this forum, but being a member of a political party, right, by definition, gives you actually an orientation in your thinking. So I can argue that being a member of a political party with a specific political ideology may not help you to have an open mind. You have a closed mind. Then, you know, we can easily say, because you're a member of that political party, you're biased. You have a conflict of interest.
Councillor Rawlings.
Liam, what would you change? Obviously, we're here to vote on this proposed code of conduct and the amended one that's been put before us. What in there would you change to deal with the concerns that you've got? Because that's what I'm struggling with at the moment. I don't know what... I'm not quite sure what you're asking the committee to change, because I don't think there is something we should change, because this mirrors what we had before in terms of conflicts of interest. So what do you think we could change in this code of conduct that would alleviate the concerns you've got? Or is it just a more general point you're making about conflicts of interest?
I at the moment I'm making some general points, but this actually is something which is troubling me quite a lot, about actually the exact definition of conflict of interest. And I mean, I don't really have anything to a specific recommendation at the moment, but actually I need some time to reflect upon this, and possibly in one of our meetings in the future, if I have the opportunity, I may come up with more specific recommendations on my part.
Yeah.
I just want to put forward my difficulties with the definition of conflict of interest here. I just want to put it actually on the table.
Councillor Bentley, or Councillor Rollins.
So I think having heard what Leanne said, understand it, but I don't think that changes my view tonight, which is that I would like to propose that we do adopt the amended code that's been put before us tonight. I think in the future, if Leanne's looked at it and thinks that there are amendments, then as we do now, it can be put on the agenda and we can debate it and decide if there should be changes made. But for now, and given what's in front of us tonight, I would propose that we adopt the amended code.
Thank you. Councillor Bentley.
I'll second that, Chair.
You'll second that proposal.
Can I just clarify, Chair, that it appears to me that what the committee has proposed and seconded is recommendation B on page 11. So it's a recommendation to full council to adopt the amended LGA code. It'd also be useful, Chair, and I don't know whether the committee has a view on whether you prefer the effective date to be the 1st of April 2022, or whether you prefer to introduce it for the new civic year, which would be early in May next year. I mean, we will have to arrange training for all 52 members, so from our point of view, from myself and Karen's point of view, the new civic year might be more deliberate, but obviously I'll be interested to hear the views of the committee on an effective date.
Rollins.
Yeah, I think new civic year, I was just about to make the point that everyone's got to be trained, and obviously that will then become a breach if we're not trained, so we need to give time for that. So yeah, the new civic year makes sense.
Councillor Bentley.
I'll second that.
So we have a proposal to adopt the policy, for it to go to full council, and to over this full civic year. So we've got time for training.
You happy with that upwording?
Yeah. 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 Okay. All those in favour?
And you need to ask in the room.
There's four in the room, and the people on the screen, could you vote if you were in favour, please?
Mary?
I'd like to abstain, please.
Okay, and Councillor Draycott would like to abstain. Thank you.
Sorry, Chair, before we move on, can I just clarify that if full council decides to adopt the code as the amended code as you're recommending, we'll obviously then let our town and parish councils know and try and encourage them to adopt a similar version of the updated yeah. code yeah. as well.
Is everyone
the
same happy reason. With that? Yeah. Yes. Happy with yes. that. Yeah, everyone in the room is happy with that.
Yeah.
Six, item seven now then.
Well, let me introduce again, Chair.
Yeah, it's a code of conduct complaints procedure, and so, the monitoring officer will Adrian will.
I think I've said within this report that this will depend to some extent on your decision in relation to adopting the code of conduct based on the LGA code. The LGA have also issued some guidance on dealing with complaints relating to their national code of conduct. So what I've done is I've set out within this report the main differences between our current procedures and the LGA recommendations, and they're set out starting on page 42, and I'll just summarise them very briefly, Chair. So the LGA are recommending that there should be no right of appeal at any stage during the consideration of a member conduct complaint. And I think their reasoning is that the system should be efficient and proportionate. It's supposed to be a light touch system. So I think in the LGA's view that there shouldn't be a right of appeal at any stage. And we currently have a right of appeal at the fact-finding stage, where if I decide it shouldn't progress to an investigation, the complainant can appeal. That then the complainant has 10 days to appeal, the subject member has 10 days to respond, and then it goes to the chair and vice chair of this committee to decide what they want to do in relation to the appeal. We have had a few appeals under that process. It can, as I say, add up to over a month onto resolving a complaint. On every appeal we've had, the chair and the vice chair have decided not to progress the appeal. The other stage where we currently have an appeal is after if a complaint goes to a hearing and the hearing finds that it has been breached of the code of conduct, we have a right of appeal at that stage. Members of the committee may remember we curtailed that somewhat a couple of years ago, where the appeal can now only be on the basis of a breach of procedure or if new evidence has come to light. But the LGA recommendation is that there shouldn't be an appeal at any stage. The other differences are the LGA go into an awful lot of detail about informal resolution at the initial stages of a complaint. Our current process basically just says it's an option and leaves it to me to decide what to do to try to resolve complaints informally. Now, the most common way of resolving complaints informally is if a councillor who's been complained about and the complainant are willing to accept an apology. Because obviously if the council is willing to apologise for something they've done wrong and the complainant is willing to accept that apology, that complaint is then resolved informally. It doesn't need to go to an investigation or a hearing. The next difference is we have no time period specified for completing an investigation. Some investigations we have undertaken have lasted many months. And despite myself and Karen progress chasing on several occasions, they can be very time consuming. The LGA specify a maximum time period of 6 months for an investigation. I believe that's very achievable. So if we wanted to introduce that 6 month time scale, I think that would be achievable and sensible. They also have some additional sanctions that we don't currently have available to us. So the additional sanctions that they recommend our removal from outside body appointments, that would have to be a recommendation to cabinet within the borough. Withdrawal of facilities such as IT equipment, internet and email access for a specified period, and also exclusion from council premises for a specified period except for the legal right to attend council or committee meetings. So I think those are potential other sanctions that you may wish to consider adding into the range of sanctions that we currently have. And I think those are the main differences, Chair, and obviously happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Councillor Bentley.
Well, Councillor Rowley's actually had his hand up slightly before me, so I'll then go first.
Sorry, Councillor Rowley.
So dealing with the points in turn, I wouldn't be at all keen to see the right to appeal removed. And I think we should keep it as it is. It, ultimately, in my view, we've got a very reasonable monitoring officer at the moment, but we don't know who we may have in the future. And we may get some decisions that just don't quite sit right with members or with people involved in the complaint process. And I think the right to appeal, if there's a legitimate reason, is you know, fundamental. So I wouldn't be keen to see that changed. The guidance on the informal resolutions, I don't really think there's much to be said about that. I'm not quite sure if we're being asked to adopt the kind of, or recommend that we adopt the additional guidance or not, but I don't really think there's much to be changed given how rarely it appears to be used. The time limit on a complaint I think is important, because if someone's got a complaint hanging over them 6 months, although from you know council's point of view it might not seem like that long, but for individuals involved in that process, 6 months is a long time. And if they've got something, if we're considering people's mental health and wellbeing, then I think 6 months is an appropriate limit. As for sanctions, we always say as a committee there aren't enough teeth to what we can you know use against councillors as and when there are breaches, so I would completely support the introduction of new sanctions. So I definitely think we should progress that. And again, the appeal at hearing stage, I think we've done quite a good job of refining that a couple of years ago, so I think we should keep it as it is. So those are my views.
Sorry, I just didn't quite catch what you said about the second point. Can you just repeat it?
I don't think there's anything to change, so I think just leave it as it is at the moment.
Well, I'd like to second that and agree with everything Councillor Rollins has just said. And it was me who was pushing for the appeal process a few years ago, as you recall. And so I couldn't possibly vote for that. I completely agree with with Councillor Rollins on this, on all the aspects of what he's just mentioned.
Any other councillors got any comments? No? So we have a proposal from Councillor Rollins that we keep the right to appeal and that the 6 months time limit is a good idea, good proposal. And we have a second from Councillor Bentley.
Also the sanctions. We adopt the sanctions.
And the sanctions.
So, Chair, is it worth going through the recommendations on page 40? So yes, my understanding is
I think it would be
You're not recommending 1A. You're not recommending 1B. You are recommending 1C. You are recommending 1D, and you're not recommending 1E.
Correct.
So just to clarify, Chair, I think that's a proposal that's been seconded.
Yeah, so we have a vote on that. All those in favour in the room? That's four. One on the screen. Is that approved or?
Approved.
Thank you. Yeah. Two on the screen. Thank you.
Three on the screen.
One of them is the council.
I know. That's what I thought.
So, item number nine then. The work programme. That's Karen.
It is.
Karen Widdowson, thank you very much.
Thank you. This is the work programme and it's set out in the appendix. I do have a matter to raise under this. Under the Register of Members' Interests, you can see this is only submitted if the level of responses received drops significantly. We did actually have a 6-monthly review undertaken at the end of September, and I'm afraid to say that the response rate was at 13.46%, so it was actually quite low. So potentially, even though it's not a requirement that we do this, would you like a report back at a future meeting about the response rate, or would you just like me to, what would you like to do?
Councillor Rollins.
Adrian.
I was just going to add, Chair, that one option may be you could ask Karen informally to let Group Whips know who's responded and who hasn't, where obviously some councillors aren't in parties but most are, so that would be an informal option.
Yeah, I'd support that because I don't want to waste Democratic Services time or committee time, so I think if we can just have a gentle nudge given we're not obliged to do it, that would be the proportionate thing to do.
As opposed to being on the work programme, we do it as informally.
Councillor Hadji Nicolau, any comments? Any comments on that, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Councillor Draycott?
Yes, if I may. If I recall correctly, the email we get asks if you've got any changes to make, then only reply back.
It doesn't.
So you could assume that, 87% haven't got any changes. So maybe what needs to be done is that in the email that goes out, you actually ask for a definite yes or no, and then you would have an answer to that question. Because at the moment, it could well be, as I say, that 80-odd% of the members haven't got a change to make the way the emails are worded. Thank you.
Councillor Bentley.
What was the actual percentage again?
13.46%, very precise, nearly 14%.
It's 86.6, never replied.
No, but I'm just thinking of the 52 councillors, and that's what the statistical percentage is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but they're not all asked to reply, they're only asked to reply if they want to make a change. That's my point.
Karen Wilson.
My understanding is that the email at present does actually say, please can you respond positively or not to this response. Maybe we can word it in a much clearer way, that if we don't hear from you, then this will be taken that in a negative way. But we can reword it on the next 6 months when it goes out. So,
good. Councillor Rawlings?
I think, Councillor Draycott, you are right. I've just had a look at the email and it does say we're only asking councillors to respond if there are changes to your circumstances.
Yeah.
You do not need to get in touch if there aren't any changes to be made. So I think there's been a bit of a
change
there.
So
in
actually,
what we're
the response saying could be 100%.
Yeah.
I
did wonder why it had gone down
so
much.
Yeah, we probably need to. So I was just thinking in my head, I don't remember responding, but equally, I'm sure that is because I'll have read that and been told not to. So I think we probably, maybe we need to just amend that wording.
Yeah, I can do that.
Before we
amend the wording, then asking councillors to respond.
Yeah.
On the next review.
Yeah. On the next review,
I don't think we need to do it separately to that.
No.
And
the next
then we'll identify who's not responded after the WIP. So
all councillors happy with that?
More than happy.
Yeah. And then the rest of the work programme, are you okay with that? That's...
Councillor Rollins.
Just one, I'm sure we spoke about this a year or two ago about the planning code, which obviously we've discussed tonight with that one change. But I was looking at the notes and I can't see that we've specific comments on it. So we last looked at this in December 2019, but it is an annual, I think it is pretty much an annual standing item.
Yes, it is.
And I think it was in 2019, there was a bit of a debate about whether it needs to be an annual item or not.
Mm.
But I don't know, I just wonder what people's thoughts are on that, because I'm just conscious that tonight we've made, I think, a good change, but quite often we just end up wrapping up a lot of officer time and not actually making any amendments to it. So I don't know, I just wonder if it should be an annual item or if it should be, or when, I don't know, it's just my thought.
Any comments, Councillor?
Councillor Rawlings, I actually just like dozed off there for a second. Which item are we talking about?
So we're looking at what we've debated tonight, so the review of the Member Code of Conduct and Planning Code, which is an annual standing item, but I know a couple of years ago we debated whether or not it should be an annual item, because I think Richard Bent was coming along, spending quite a lot of time prepping for it, and then not really having much involvement. But equally, I'm conscious that if we don't have it on any form of review, then we might not look at it as often as we should do. So I don't know how else we could deal with it.
Sure. Could I propose make it a biannual?
I mean, that's what we've done now, isn't it? We skipped 2020.
Yeah.
What happened was we actually had no comments back in 2019, so therefore there was no need to actually put it on the agenda because there were no comments.
Yeah.
Whereas, it's because there's no point, but if there were comments, like... be it one comment, then we've put it on the agenda.
But
Councillor Rollins.
Maybe, as Councillor Bentley says, biennial is more sensible because you're more likely to have changes arise. And if something really important was found to be an issue with the code, there's nothing stopping us bringing it on the agenda sooner to deal with it as a standalone issue. So I think probably biennial makes more sense then.
Councillor Bailey?
Again, I completely agree with Councillor Rollins and Councillor Bentley that the two-year rolling review. I'd be more than happy with that.
Adrian?
Just for the sake of clarity, Chair, obviously we do an annual review of the Constitution, and the Planning Code of Good Practice is part of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So if a councillor suggested a change in the interim year, we would still have to bring it to you in the way we've done tonight. Mm. If that makes sense. Well,
it wouldn't
come to you, but if somebody said, I think you need to change, come to you anyway.
Well, we're not suggesting it can't be discussed.
Yeah, it's the opportunity, isn't it? Is there for it to change?
I think that's the way to do it. I think every 2 years is a reasonable period of time. You're likely to find issues that aren't desperate that can be dealt with at the next time we address it. If something desperate arises, then we should hear it sooner and deal with it. But I think that probably that same goes for the Constitution. It's not a document that you need to update every few months or even every year. Quite often, I guess, we pass with very minor changes. So I think it's probably the same for the Constitution.
Any other comments, councillors? No? So do we have to vote on that?
A general consensus seems to be that with that particular item, the next time it comes forward is December 2023, which would be after the next elections, which makes sense in some respects.
Everyone in the room's happy with that?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's good then.
Okay.
And everyone, all the councillors are happy with that? Yes?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's
it. Date of the next meeting.
That concludes the meeting. When's the date of the next meeting?
It is on the 21st of March 2022.
21st of March 22. Can I say all Merry Christmas, everybody, and Happy New Year?
And
is there a call?
Yeah, Merry Christmas.